This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg, and with me this week are two fantastic comic book people, Nick White, writer for Destroy the Cyborg, and Paul Jaisley, staff writer and contributor for Destroy the Cyborg. Thank you guys for joining me this week. I'm so excited to be back after, I think I missed two episodes in a row. I don't know. I feel like I haven't been on the show in a forever. So thank you guys for joining me. How have comic books been? How have you guys been?
Well, Mike, welcome back. It's good to have you back. You were missed.
You're dead to me. 2 weeks, a month. I don't know how long it was.
Out of sight, out of mind, I guess, right?
Apparently, yeah.
Damn straight.
Well, regardless of our opinions of Mike, I think...
let's not regardless. Let's talk about this. New topic.
Leaves for 2 weeks, talk to me about comic books, please. Yeah, that's what I came here for, okay?
Yeah, we can disagree about Mike, but we can all agree that comics are great, right?
If you don't want to hear Mike rapping drama, just skip this episode.
You're only about
45 seconds in at this point. I mean,
you really got to stop. You have to stop telling people to not listen.
Yes, please, please.
Anyway, I want to talk about comics. So
yes, please, me too.
I read a handful this week, and a few I want to mention. I read one of the strangest comics I've read in a long time. It was the 2001 Space Odyssey adaptation by the one and only Jack Kirby. It came out in the mid 70s. He did a big oversized adaptation of the movie, which led to a 12 issue series that he did based on ideas from the movie. Obviously has no connection to the movie at that point, but
okay.
It's something I've always wanted to read, but it's very hard to find because they can't reprint it, as far as I know, since Marvel doesn't own the rights to the movie anymore. But anyway, I was at a Comic Con a couple weeks ago and I found the big oversized adaptation of the movie, and it's wild. And something about that movie just made Jack Kirby's already overactive imagination that much more excited. And he clearly just loves the idea of the movie, and he draws the shit out of this book. It's beautiful. And plus, it's that big, oversized, magazine-sized comic. Yeah, it's stunning. So I was glad I finally got a chance to sit down and read that, because it's mind-blowing.
That's just crazy that, like, whoever like was the editor on that assignment was like, look, this movie is already going to be sort of out there and really, you know, striking, and we need to make sure that nobody like fucking, you know, goes insane. Who do we want to put on this? Oh, I don't know, Jack Kirby. Oh, yeah. good, and because he won't totally go nuts.
Oh, and it's great because this is prime unfiltered 70s Kirby when he's writing and drawing. He's editing it, so it's just out there. And the writing is over the top.
I love that it sounds like that's those Star Wars comics I was reading where, like, they're like, okay, we have to decide what happens next. And we really, you know what? You've got one movie to go on. Just decide what happens next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it was great. I can't wait to track down the other issues that follow up. You know, there's not like there's a lot to follow up with that movie. The ending's pretty conclusive. So I'm curious what exactly Jack Kirby had planned for those characters after that, but
yeah, that's interesting, especially considering I mean, didn't the movie have two or three? I know the book had like three or four sequels, but
they did do a sequel to the movie that came out years and years later, so, but I've never seen that, so I don't know how much of a connection there is. I feel like it's just an adaptation of the novel that came after, so
yeah, 2010, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I think so.
Not quite as well regarded as the Kubrick original, as far as I can
right.
tell.
Right.
Anyway, so I read that. And my mind was more or less shaken and blown beyond repair after that.
Mm-hmm.
But I read a couple number one issues that came out this past week or so. Twilight Children number one, which was my pick a couple weeks ago. Finally got around to reading that. And oh my God, what a stunning comic book.
I haven't gotten to it yet. It's still in my stack.
Oh, it's so
likewise,
good.
Likewise.
Gilbert Hernandez and Darwin Cook and Dave Stewart on colors. Just a tremendous comic. And it's really interesting because I've read a lot of Hernandez's stuff, and there are a few sequences where it feels like Darwin Cook is channeling Gilbert Hernandez's art style, at least in terms of layout of the page.
Hmm. Really?
Hernandez is Lock and Key, right? Or am I...
No, you're thinking
Gabriel Rodriguez, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But Love and Rockets is what he does, and Hernandez. And I don't know if that's because Cook, you know, is reading Hernandez's stuff and trying to emulate it, because thematically it's very similar to a lot of the Love and Rockets stuff Gilbert Hernandez did in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. Or if they did like layouts together, which wouldn't surprise me. Like Hernandez might have just sent Darwin Cook some thumbnails. Like, this is what I'm thinking for the layouts. But either way, it's a tremendous comic by two masters of the art form. So you have to let me know what you guys think when you read it.
For sure.
Okay.
Art Ops number one, the new Vertigo series from Mike Allred, drawn by Mike Allred and written by Sean Simon. I kind of picked this up on a whim. I've always dug Allred's art. Right. But I end up really enjoying the premise of the issue as well. It's about these sort of this group of art critics, I think, who are protecting valuable works of art by taking the subjects out. So in this issue, they take Mona Lisa out of the painting and replace her with a stand-in, not to protect the work of art so much, but protect the subject of the artwork itself, Mona Lisa.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
I've seen some interior shots of that, and it looks wild. Like, Mike Allred has always done some wild stuff with his art, but this one is to, like, that next level of, like, acid drop, hangout weird stuff. I don't know. Yeah.
He seems very, you know, enthused about it, you know, because I really like his Madman stuff. I was reading that when it was coming out in the late 90s and stuff, when I was reading comics back then, and I loved that stuff, and I loved him experimenting with layouts and art, the art form and stuff. But when he was doing the FF stuff with Matt Fraction, mm-hmm. it didn't seem to have that same sort of excitement or energy to it.
Totally.
You know, I don't know if just because it was just like a work-for-hire kind of thing. This feels much more like his Madman stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, my only thought on FF was it felt like he was trying to just emulate Jack Kirby stuff.
That's true, yeah.
And that kind of like, especially with his, you know, early Fantastic Four stuff, it was very comic booky. And I think that's what they were trying to do with that book. But anyways, on to what else you read.
And then also, I just want to mention Black Magic number one by Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott. Again, kind of picked it up on a whim. Greg Rucka is a guy who I always like his stuff more or less, but it doesn't always click with me. Like I mentioned, I think a couple times on this podcast, his Lazarus didn't really do much for me when I read the first couple issues. I wasn't sure if I would dig Black Magic. Turns out he hit the nail on the head. When Greg Rucka is doing a book about a sort of female detective, somehow that just works for me. Like, I think that's what he's the best at writing.
Absolutely.
Pigeonholed him, but
I hate to say that, but it, like, all the books he does with that premise, I've loved. So
I think he just does police drama really, really well. Like, he does police procedural really well.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that's necessarily pigeonholing him to say that he's really good at that. I think he's done other work that is very good, but I think what he's best at is police stories.
I'm just joking that if people are like, Greg Rucka, you've got to stick to mystery female narratives in that, you know, just stay there.
Yeah.
Don't move.
I thought this was fantastic. And Nicola Scott's artwork is just lovely on this book. And I think we'll have a lot to say about it when we talk about, you know, coloring and stuff later on in the episode. And then speaking of Greg Rucka, I also read Stumptown number 8, which is another book he does, which features a female detective. But she's not a police officer, she's a private investigator. I loved the first volume of Stumptown a lot, and the following volumes have not quite been as strong, in my opinion, but still an enjoyable book. The premise is kind of basically, if you imagine the Rockford Files with a female lead set in Portland, Oregon, it kind of is right up my alley, too. So even though it's not as great as the first volume, I'm still enjoying this story. It feels kind of, I don't know, satirical, since the mystery that the main character is solving involves very expensive coffee beans, and there's a barista mafia that she runs across that's causing her trouble. It's a little jokey, but again, it's Greg Rucka doing a strong female detective type character, and it just works for me because it's a little more light tone than his other stuff, and it's kind of interesting book to compare that, especially reading it right after Black Magic. So
well,
that's what I read. What about you, Nick?
Well, interestingly enough, every single book that Paul mentioned, aside from that first crazy one, they're all books that are sitting on my shelf, and I haven't read them yet. Probably because I'm worried that I don't have the time to truly soak it in. But clearly I've got time because I went and read other stuff. So maybe I'm just afraid of the intellectual challenge that they pose. That's probably it. There you go. don't like them their thinking books. So that being said, I just read all of Secret Wars, and no, I'm just kidding.
I will fly back to Michigan and just cut you a little bit in, like, right, in between your fingers, just to make you hurt. Just to make you hurt, man.
Well, just make sure before you leave, I'll give you my copy of Sandman Overture number 6, so at least one of us can enjoy
it. Ding, ding, ding. We've hit all the bells for this week's episode. Thank you. This has been the I Read Comic Books
for those podcast. Who have been keeping track, you now have a bingo on your I Read Comic Books play-along card. Perfect. That's right. Yeah. No, I finally getting around to rereading some old stuff and some stuff that I'd been putting off. Probably the biggest thing was I actually read Rye Volume 1. I tried before in the past, but it's definitely Valiant's, I would say, most ambitious and most dense read. There's a lot going on, and I think a lot of it simply has to do with just the pure fact that Matt Kent has been tasked with creating this, you know, Japan in the World 4000, and unlike every other Valiant book, for the most part, Rye remains sort of a standalone book, which is sort of interesting because in the previous iteration of Rye back in the 90s, if I remember this correctly, Rye actually runs on a very advanced version of the system or the nanites that fuel Bloodshot, which is why, to some extent, there's a bit of a aesthetic similarity between the two characters.
Oh, we haven't even gotten there in the story. I think that that's coming. As someone who reads Rye month to month, there are some very heavy hints at a lot of stuff like that. So just
that they're finally gonna, yeah. Well, and you know what's interesting is finally getting around to reading it now, I'm actually reaching points where I'm seeing very, very, just very slender, just slim connections with the rest of the universe, which is actually why I went and reread Unity Volume 2. Because there's a guy in Rye Volume 1 called Dr. Silk, who's been alive like for hundreds and thousands of years due to all these crazy scientific processes that he's come up with. I'm sure you remember him a bit, Mike. And he's actually the supervillain in Unity Volume 2. So it's interesting to actually see this character who's actually managed to find his way into both universes. Mm-hmm. I think the only other exception would be Ivar Timewalker, who actually jumps into the year 4000 Japan in one of his issues, and you actually see Rye in the window, so that was a neat little thing they're doing. So, yeah, Rye was good. Like I said, really dense read. Had to take some time with that, but Clayton Crane's art is... Nothing else looks like it. Period. End of story.
I totally agree.
It's slick and it's polished, and it's everything you would sort of imagine for a very streamlined, futuristic looking protagonist. I read Secret 6 Volume 7, sorry, Issue 7. That would be the first issue of the second arc. Hats off to Gail Simone. She really went wild in just roping in a whole bunch of DC's magic-based characters. Because at least if I understood the issue right, I'd have to really go back and reread 6 to make certain I've got everything completely right. The character called, is it Black Mary? No, it's Black Alice. I think that's it. She's going through like the magic version of puberty, and it's causing her to like drain the magic resources from like the world. And so all these other wizards have to come together and like, they're like, this is not, I don't know, it's not supposed to happen this way, or it's not supposed to be this powerful, but like they're having to decide whether or not, and it's kind of comical, they're up for basically killing this kid because she's draining all of their magic, and it's Dead Man, and it's Felix Faust, and Etrigan, and Jason Blood, and all these fun characters getting together. So it was really neat to see Simone utilize all of those people within the DC universe. What else? Wild's End, The Enemy Within, second arc of Wild's End, which has a soft spot in my heart. I'm just a huge Wind in the Willows fan. Anytime you've got like toads and and like badgers, you know, wearing 1930s golfing caps and you know, smoking cigars and driving around in old cars and, you know, with, you know, old style shotguns shooting at aliens in a War of the Worlds homage. I mean, honestly, like, there's a subgenre. You want to talk about, like, subgenres that are way too overly focused, but I would read forever? Yes. Wind in the Willows, fighting aliens, perfect. Perfect, perfect.
This is the day that Nick's going to debut his secret fan fiction collection that he's been writing for years.
Well, you know, I have not forgiven Disneyland for getting rid of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I mean, you lost a customer there, Disney. I don't know what your numbers look like. I don't know how bad it's going to hurt you, but you know, I hope. Speaking of analytics, I hope you've done your numbers, because here's one person that will not be showing up in until the Star Wars rides are built. Then I'll show up. Then I'll show up. Dang. So do that. One other thing, I guess. I read Fall of Harbinger, finally. It's a Book of Death tie-in, obviously. And the one that I was sort of least invested in. Harbinger is just not a thing I'm that crazy about, because really, it's just sort of X-Men. And that's not a knock on X-Men.
Harbinger is
the Institute.
Oh, right. Which okay, okay.
Run by Toyo Harada. Yes.
In the Valiant Universe. Okay, sorry. I had to find it in my brain. Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah. And it's very X-Men-y to me. It's like I've seen this before, so what's the point? And it was trippy, it was interesting. Kano's art was good, but ultimately just not that invested. One more to go, Fall of Exo Man of War. We'll see how that is. I've got that sitting on my shelf. What about you, Mike? What did you read?
I'm gonna read mine in reverse order, because I have a lot to say about the last two.
Okay.
So I read Fresh Romance number 6, which is the anthology series. That's a Comixology submit book that was backed on Kickstarter. I think I've mentioned it a couple times in this podcast. I absolutely love this series, just because it's just like Archie, in the sense that it's like a breath of fresh air. Like, there's nothing being taken too seriously. It's covering topics that I think that aren't necessarily used in a lot of other comics, or I should say the vast majority of comics, which in the sense that this is an anthology series all about like three or four romance stories about people falling in love and the trials and tribulations of being in a relationship with someone. And there is no like line about where I should say like what types of stories they're going to cover. It's all just revolved around people falling in love or being in relationships. And it's very like I haven't read a bad story in this yet. And it, like, I think the first four or five issues covered the same three stories, and then this most recent issue covered a new story. And then of course we found out that they're the editor, and I think the publisher, I think I can't think of her name, Janelle, I feel so bad about this, she is stepping down, I think, as the editor-in-chief, or I could be wrong, but she's basically stepping away from the project because she's had some problems in her life, and it's, like, all the power to her, because, like, she's at least making the, like, adult decision to say, you know, I don't think I can handle this, but I believe in this project, to where even though I started it, I want someone else to see it through, because it needs to be done because of how important this book is. I completely agree. I can't recommend this book enough to people, only because just the vast number of creators on it is astounding. Every single story is very good, and it's just something you don't see on the stands anymore. Like, the only time you hear about romance stories is in cheesy novels, and this is like a serious, well-crafted anthology series all about romance. So it, honestly, go on Comixology. If anyone is interested, I will gladly buy them number one. And if you don't like it, that's fine, but I will pay for number one if anyone's interested. So please take me up on that offer. I believe in this book that much. I also read Black Magic number one. I don't know if you guys have anything to say about that, but that's my soapbox about it. I read Black Magic number one, which was really good. I think, Paul, you pretty much spoke to every single point I have about this, okay. So yeah. I won't cover it again. I read Secret Wars number 6 because I wanted to make sure that I was completely up to date on the majority of Secret Wars stories so that I could read Uncanny X-Men number 600, followed by Extraordinary X-Men number 1.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary. Yeah. I want to sing a song now, right? Okay,
what
so
song?
I there's a song I don't know. He's okay. That song Love L is for the way you look. Yeah. All right. We won't do
no,
that.
No, that's good. That helped. But we're on the same page now.
Secret Wars number 6 was interesting. We're starting to see the fall of Doom God, at least so it seems. The Spider-Mans are involved. And Reed Richards, everyone is doing exactly what you'd expect them to do, and all I can do is root for Doom. So, even though
has
I know
Reed
he's
Richards
gonna lose.
Reached a like morally compromising point where he's gonna go evil or not?
Oh, you mean the two Reed Richardses? They are at heads.
So what? You're talking about the Spider-Mans and the Reed Richardses and,
yeah.
and the Pokemons so, and the.
So let's take a step back then for the two of you who may not be privy to the whole Secret Wars thing, so much. So the multiverse of the Marvel Universe collided, creating this quote unquote battle world. There's a better name for it, but they keep calling it battle world because nothing's better than shoehorning a title right in someone's mouth.
There's no better name for anything than battle world. I mean,
there really isn't. No.
You guys. So no, but
you know what you're getting into.
What's important is that the final two incursions were the Ultimate Marvel Universe and the Marvel Universe. Coincidentally, who'd have thunk, right?
Right.
But nonetheless, at the end of the New Avengers, this is spoilers for like all of Secret Wars up to this point, so I'm sorry, skip ahead. But anyway, so the two universes collided, ending the entire multiverse, because the Beyonders were like, this was an experiment, this whole multiverse, and we don't want to see it forward. And Doom was like, excuse me, I want to run this thing, and they were like, F you, mate. And so he killed them and took all their powers. And so that's why he's Doom God, and he crafted this world. And he's built a whole fake mythology behind it. And there's a big, longer story that goes back into John Hickman's New Avengers that also ties into his Avengers run. He's been building this for a while. But nonetheless, Doom is there, and he's controlling everything, and the two universes collided. And so the majority of characters that you know we're seeing are characters from the Ultimate Universe and from the 616 universe. And so we've got Spider-Man Peter Parker and Spider-Man Miles Morales who are teaming up to try to go investigate some things because they managed to keep all their memories of everything that happened. Reed Richards is there with the Ultimate Reed Richards, and Ultimate Reed Richards is pure evil, whereas regular Reed Richards has like a soul in some capacity. So they're trying to formulate a plan
boring.
To
the word is
Doom
boring.
At the same time. It's really cool if you just kind of like say, all right, this Kool-Aid tastes really good. And I decided that I got to at least see this one through because I want to read X-Men books again. And so I'm reading Secret Wars because Uncanny X-Men 600 took so long to come out, and I thought it was because of Secret Wars number 6. And in fact, that actually wasn't the case because Uncanny X-Men 600 had nothing to do with any of the Secret Wars stuff. And it's like the most disappointing wait for a comic I think I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Like, I honestly enjoyed the issue. I liked what Brian Michael Bendis did with the issue.
This sounds pretty positive up to this point. Bring the hammer down.
Well, no, I was really happy with the way he ended it. It was a little forced, but I think that was because I feel like Bendis thought, okay, I've got like 4 more issues. And then Marvel was like, no, you don't. So he had to shoehorn a lot of the stuff that he was trying to round off in the previous arc. Or maybe that wasn't the case, but that's at least how it felt to me. So when Uncanny X-Men 600 ends, it's cool. And then I was like, all right, that's the end of this era of the X-Men. And now starts a new era with Extraordinary X-Men number 1. And there are so many negative reviews to this book on the internet. And I feel... just
wait, is this
confused.
The Lemire one?
This is the Lemire, Jeff Lemire and Humberto Ramos on art. And I don't care for Ramos's art, but God damn it, I will have an X-Men book in my life. Like, I need one because I'm not going to read the stupid Secret Wars tie-ins because I don't care about what's happening on the periphery of Secret Wars. I care about the primary story. So this is a fresh X-Men story, and I'm like, I'll try it. Storm is at the helm. She's running this... what seems to be Xavier Institute that they call X-Haven, and something bad happened, and there's all this mystery about everything, and it's supposedly this story takes place 8 months after the end of Secret Wars, so whatever. Call bullshit.
So
call
tell me, what's making everybody mad, Mike?
I'll get to it. So this takes place 8 months later, and this book read to me like like when I first started getting into X-Men, and I had all these questions, and I was like, what do I need to read? What do I need to know? What backstory do I need to have in order to understand this? I'll roll with all these punches if it means that you'll give me answers, right? Now, when I was doing this, and this is tied into my history, which is why I love this book. When I was doing this originally, I was reading it in volumes, you know, Grant Morrison's New X-Men, Chuck Austin's Uncanny X-Men, Extreme X-Men by Chris Claremont. Like, that was a key time to be reading X-Men as far as I'm concerned. And I was reading all those in trades, and I just had question after question, and they were answering them and then adding more mystery, and that was great. And so this number one had that exact same feeling, but there's nothing else to read, and that's because we're at the beginning of this new story. Now, everyone on the internet's like, or at least all the reviews that I read online that are negative are like, well, this story feels contrived, like they don't explain actually what the problem is, like they don't even address Secret Wars, they don't even do this, they don't even do that. And it's like, isn't this how like an X-Men number one is supposed to start? Where they because the basic story is that humans are trying to kill all mutants, who'd have thunk, you know, because they see them as this, you know, awful thing because of what Scott Summers did or something that Scott Summers did that they don't answer for. It's not what happened in Uncanny X-Men 600. It's what happened in between the 8 months that we don't know about. So this kind of feels like, you know, New 52, where there was that absent year, right? And they kind of explain things. But I'm like, I'm totally on board for this. I'm like, I want this, the underdog X-Men back again, where they're fighting for their own and everyone's got, you know, their relationships are, you know, like in tangles and stuff, because X-Men is just a soap opera. And that's what I want. And they're focusing on key characters and, you know, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, Bobby Drake, Iceman, aka Iceman, and not Wolverine, but Old Man Wolverine or Old Man Logan shows up at the end. So
does he demand that they call him that?
No. He just shows up in the last page. Spoilers, whatever. He's on the cover, I'm pretty sure. So it's interesting. I'm on board. I'm totally excited for this X-Men. And Jeff Lemire, I have no worries. Like, there's no way this guy screws up this book. You know what I mean?
I thought about Justice League United. I'm going to warn you with that one.
I don't know how well he does teams, so we'll see.
It almost seems like people aren't aware that Lemire is much more about developing characters and character interaction than plot. And that's not to say he's a poor plotter. It's just not number one on the docket for him. And so if people are demanding that, you know, he get the ball moving and get the ball rolling and answer all the questions, like, okay, I guess if you're a big Marvel reader, you haven't had much exposure to Jeff Lemire.
Maybe you don't care.
But
with the X-Men, that's what the majority of their stories are. There's like a weak plot with a ton of character development. I mean, if anybody's asking for anything different, then please tell me, go back in the last 10 years worth of X-Men that you've been reading and tell me that's not the case.
I mean, I just love that Mike's like, look, I just want a soap opera and the plot doesn't have to be good and you don't have to answer all the questions.
No,
I just want people that are mad at each other and just give me that. I love that. That's great.
There's two ways to do number ones in my mind. There's like, give us all the answers and build it and then just have the cliffhanger at the end be a mysterious twist. Or you go into the number one with so much mystery that you go, what the hell is even happening? This is exciting. Especially with a bunch of pre-established characters.
People won't tolerate that
these days. They don't have to introduce any character. You already know who, if you're reading X-Men, you already know who Colossus is and Storm is and Nightcrawler and Wolverine and, you know what I mean? So, like, you don't need to do all the intros. Instead, you just need to establish a vague plot that seems interesting. And the story that Lemire does in the first issue or delivers to us in the first issue, it's very solid. It's just there's a lot of questions. And I think that's not a bad thing. I don't know. I feel like we always go back and forth on this. Like, people are either complaining, well, it was too in your face about what was happening, and then the hook was stupid. Or, I didn't know what was happening, and I didn't really understand it, and the ending was dumb. Like, where's the middle ground? You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
I'm all it's in a fuss like because I love this. Like, I'm so excited. That's the problem.
Yeah. It's almost like I feel with, like, Image books or whatever that people are more okay with the idea of unanswered questions, and with the big two, it's like unanswered questions are not okay.
Yeah.
Again, it's not to make broad sweeping generalizations.
No, I've already been doing it, so.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fair.
So, all right, well, let's take a quick break, and I'm going to have a breather. Then we can actually talk about our comic picks that we're excited for this week. So we'll be back in a second. Yeah. So as we do every week, let's talk about some books that we are actually excited for that aren't out yet. So Nick, do you want to tell us what your pick is for this week?
My pick for this week is Descender number 7. Of course, that's a series that is at Image Comics, and it's Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen. Lemire on writing duties and Nguyen on art, obviously, with some absolutely jaw-dropping, oh my gosh, wow, I can't believe this is actually in a comic book watercolor artwork. Mm-hmm. Can't say enough good things about his work. And this is the first issue we have had since August. As Image books are wont to do, when an arc finishes, you might, you know, suddenly not see a book for 3 or 4 months, and then you're like, wow, my pull, it's under control.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened, but this is really great. And then, like, this week, all of a sudden, Birthright's like, hey, we're back from break. And Descender's like, yeah, me too. And then I'm like, oh, fuck. But it's the first book we've had since August, so I'm really, really anxious to see where this goes. Especially considering that the end of the first arc was not really... You know, I get mad all the time about, oh, well, the twist wasn't powerful enough, or it wasn't, you know, or I saw it coming or whatever, because sometimes... You know, not everything has to be Sixth Sense or Signs or whichever good Shyamalan twist you want to go with. Sometimes it's just a little reveal and it's more necessary to where the book is going than, you know, shocking you for 5 seconds. Anyway, minor soapbox aside, yeah, surprise. Minor spoilers for the end of Descender Arc 1. We find out that there's actually more than one Tim robot left.
Oh, man.
And there's another one. And that's... really it. There aren't supposed to be any more, and yet here's another one. What does that mean? I don't really know. When it happened, I was like, okay, that's not a crazy ending. You think you're the only one and you're not, but what are the implications of such? Who knows? And I guess that's really, hopefully, where this second arc is going to go. What does it mean that there's another one? Will the other one be evil? Of course it will. Inevitably. Of course it will. Will this android robot, you know, sport a goatee and, you know, do evil stuff? Probably. I hope so. That's where I think it's going. And even if it doesn't go anywhere crazy, it's Dustin Nguyen art. So if these two robots get together and form a, you know, lawn maintenance company, I'll read that. It'll look gorgeous. That's fine. You know what? If that's where Arc 2 goes, fine. Fine. They can landscape their robot hearts out. I don't know.
So was this break, was it a planned break? Like, usually a lot of books, they'll announce it in the letter pages or something, saying, hey, we're going to take 2 or 3 months off before we start the next arc. And, you know, like Saga does that. I think Invincible's going to that route. So it was this something that you knew about, or they just like, okay, there's just a break, and you were expecting a book 1 month, and it didn't show up, and it didn't show up again, and now it's back?
Well, I haven't really read the letters to the editor, admittedly, that much in Descender. After, like, month after month, it was like, oh, dear Jeff Lemire, I really love your book. Normally, I don't read comic books, but I read this book, and I love it, and that's great. I mean, but I don't need to read letters like that for months on end. I mean, it's great right. for him, and if I were him, I would read every letter like that. I mean, I would put them up on my fridge.
Yeah.
I would buy a second fridge, and I would put more letters on that one and fill it with beer. Mm-hmm. But still, I didn't think the break was going to be this long, but when you look at Jeff Lemire, especially the things he's been doing in the last couple months as he's been transitioning over to Marvel and getting some stuff done there, it's not a huge surprise that, he probably needed a little bit of a break as he was switching over to, you know, I think he's technically one of the Marvel, I don't know what they call them, staffers or inner circle. They always talk about getting invited to the...
I don't think he has an exclusive contract with them because he's still writing stuff for Vertigo and obviously his Image book.
That's the thing. There are no true exclusive contracts anymore. All you do is you sign a contract that says you're not working for DC if you're working for Marvel, or if you're working for Marvel, you're not. And I think he has signed something to that extent. No different than Charles Soule has.
Right.
So... you know, as I think as the insiders in the industry call it, they, you know, he's made it to a point where he, quote unquote, gets invited to the writers' retreats. You know,
the well, yeah, that's circle, because he's a white guy, right? Isn't that the whole deal at Marvel? Sorry,
hey, no.
bad joke.
All right.
Well, no, I was gonna say, I was looking at his Twitter profile the other day because I wanted to make sure I spelled his name right, because for some reason I couldn't figure out how to spell it. And if you look at his bio, it says he's
J-E-F-F.
I got it. Well, I was looking at his bio, and he has like writer of Marvel book, Vertigo book, Valiant book, Image book. I'm like, this guy is touching all the major publishers. It's insane. He's been everywhere. It's incredible. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Absolutely. I'm really excited for it, especially because, with me not really being a Marvel reader, I was gonna say I really don't get much Jeff Lemire anymore, but he is writing Bloodshot Reborn, so that's not entirely true.
Right.
So that's my pick, Descender number 7.
Gotcha. What about you, Paul?
Well, my pick this week is Southern Bastards number 12. Mainly, I have to admit, because of the cover. There are a few other books coming out this week I was excited about, but when I saw the cover for Southern Bastards number 12, I knew I had to make it my pick. If you haven't seen it, the cover is a drawing of a chicken, a cartoonish chicken, wearing sunglasses, doing a karate kick and yelling "Kia" in a very stereotypical, you know, karate fashion. And I have no idea what that means for the issue itself, but as far as I can tell, this is, I don't want to call it a fill-in issue per se, but it's not written by Jason Aaron. Jason Latour is filling in on writing. And,
Really?
Yeah, Chris Brunner, I'm not familiar with that name. He's listed as doing the art for this issue.
I need to start paying attention more. Wow, okay. Didn't know.
Well, it's interesting because, like most Image books, I feel, Southern Bastards is a more collaborative, you know, than maybe a book from the big two, where Jason Aaron and Jason Latour are clearly working together. It's not so much working together to script the issues and write them, as opposed to Jason Aaron just writing the issue and Jason Latour drawing it. So it's not strange that Jason Latour would just take up the writing duties for one issue. And also, he's a writer himself. He writes, you know, exactly, Spider-Gwen.
Right.
But
yeah, that doesn't make me anxious at all. The writing thing doesn't worry me one bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm okay with that.
So, I mean, that's, I don't want to call it a film issue, but it feels like if you're putting a karate-kicking chicken-wearing sunglasses on the cover of Southern Bastards, I'm guessing the contents might be a little more lighthearted than the past few issues have been. The past few issues of Southern Bastards have been pretty dark and pretty violent. So
yeah,
if this is kind of a step back and a more lighthearted issue, which I'm kind of hoping it is, I'm kind of excited because part of what makes Southern Bastards so interesting is the way that Jason's Latour and Aaron bring their personal history and their feelings about Southern culture to the book, you know? Obviously, the book is very critical about the South, but it's also a reflection of two guys that grew up there and have strong feelings about it. And I love that every issue has somebody can like write in with an old family recipe and they'll print it. So it does. It's a celebration of certain elements of Southern culture. And if this is a book that's maybe an issue that kind of plays up to that, I'd be very curious to see it, as opposed to the very dark, gritty violence that have been perpetrated in the past couple issues. Yeah.
So, last month was crazy.
I love this book. I think it's fantastic, but there's some issues I need to, you know, put the book down, go wash my hands, you know, maybe take a shower.
Decompress.
Exactly. Oh, man.
It's just, yeah.
Whenever I got this book, I immediately put, like, Bob's Burgers behind it in my reading queue.
Just cleanse the palate, right?
Yeah. Gotta be prepared.
I was gonna ask, I know, so clearly you're reading this, Nick. Mike, are you reading this book, or have you?
Oh, God. Everybody I know that reads this book is like, Mike, why aren't you reading this? And my only excuse is that I think number one just didn't hook me, and maybe I should give the trade a chance. You know what I mean? And I'm willing to do that, given how much I've heard about this and how much, I guess not necessarily positive, like, regards, but, like, people say this is a good book to read, period. And that's not necessarily like a positive thing. That's just saying this is a good book. Like, I don't know. It's that sounds weird, but it's important. Yeah. That's what I mean. So I might give the trade a chance, especially you. I mean, I trust the two of you in terms of like book recommendations, and two other podcasts that I listened to have said this book is great. It's like once you hear enough people say you should at least try it, maybe I should go more than just the first issue and maybe not be so tired like I was the first time I read it. And that might've thrown me a little bit.
I
would say like the first trade, that arc is perfect. Your mileage may vary after the first arc. And that's certainly why this book ends up on the fence a lot recently for me, because arc 2 is honestly one of the best prequel stories I've ever, and I'm sure I'm retreading ground here, but arc 2 was a great prequel story. Mm-hmm. And most of the time they're like, we're going to do an origin story next, and you just roll your eyes and you're like, oh boy. But it was good.
Yeah.
And arc 3, honestly, to me, feels like a small series of vignettes, each issue covering a different bit character in the city. And I've said it a million times before. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, Paul. Maybe this doesn't bug you. Maybe it does. But what they teased at the end of arc 1, I am still waiting for that. And it's the anticipation of that and how strong the anticipation is of that that has kept me reading this book, even when I've seriously been wondering if and when they're ever going to go there.
No, that's a good point. I like the fact that the book is willing to take some time to flesh out the setting and the background characters like they're doing with this current arc, you know? But without giving too much away, this current arc is also called Homecoming, which lends me to believe that what's hinted at, or the character that's hinted at,
start paying attention
in the first arc, might be showing up more regularly. You know, but you're right. That is odd that they really, the first arc ends with such an important note, and there's a hint at an important character that we haven't really seen yet, and we're 6-7 issues down the road now. Jason Aaron's a guy that's good at playing the long game, though, so I think when it eventually happens, it's going to be worth the wait. At least that's what I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much is he paying you?
He's paying me in barbecue. So.
Oh man, so that's a nice paycheck.
It is probably the most fun letters to the editor page in a book.
I usually skip letters to the editor, and I read every one in Southern Bastards.
It's like that one for me, and then it's Harrow County's letters to the editor.
Gotcha. Well, my pick for this week is The Autumnlands Tooth and Claw number 7, simply because this is a book I haven't seen in a while. This book
is this the beginning of arc 2?
I think this is the beginning of arc 2. Like, it's been so long that I'm just like kind of blurry about what exactly happened at the end of issue 6, and I know what happened, but I'm kind of curious to see where they're actually going to take this story, because there was a lot of high promises in issue 1 of the series, and by the end of issue 6, the book, I feel like, had gone in a different direction. Not so much that, like, I didn't know it was coming or it feels like a different book, but, like, it definitely took a grittier, more, like, without spoiling it too
bloody
much. But, yeah, it's just a bloodier turn. Direction. And I was kind of hoping for more, like, cool magic shit. And this book, they've got the anthropomorphic animals, and there's this implication about a man from another dimension, and so on and so forth. But I'm really curious to see where arc 2 is going to go, and so I'm completely blind about what's happening, because this could be a flash forward, this could be all sorts of things. I think, I want to say there was like talk of other wizards across the world, so like, who knows? I'm only looking forward to it because I'm just excited to have this book back in my pull, and because I love the art, I love Kurt Busiek's storytelling capabilities, and this book has been a fun ride in terms of like I said, it went a different direction, but I didn't dislike it. I actually really enjoyed it, but it's a different story than what I initially thought it was going to be in issue 1. So maybe he's going to do another, twist or go a different direction for this arc. So I'm excited to see where it goes. And that's pretty much the long and short of it.
Did you feel that the book was unfairly the protagonist or narrative heft was unfairly shifted onto the human character, and you felt maybe that didn't need to be the case? Is that
yes,
what?
Yes, that's exactly it. I was really hoping for more stories with
From the younger dog.
Yeah, from the dog character. And he is still the primary narrator for the most part.
I would say so.
But the story is not about him. And that's okay, because I there is something to be said about a story told by a character about another character within a story. Like, it's almost like a story within a story, because you're getting, like, another character's perceptions of actions. And I do enjoy that, because I think we don't get that very often in comics, or maybe I'm making too broad of a generalization there, but I really like it. It's almost like a journal of this character, and then we're seeing the live action. And then there's something that has not even closely been explained, and I don't think will be, because it's way too meta for them to even talk about it, I think. There are these, like, at the beginning of each issue, like, they'll do, like, 4 or 5 pages, and then they'll do, like, what looks like a cutout of a book.
Oh, yeah.
With, like,
a very
beautiful mural in the background, and, like, describing something that's seemingly either very slightly related to the actual story, or just like a weird excerpt from a story that maybe is doing some sort of metaphorical, like, description of what's going to happen or what could happen. And maybe I'm not catching on to it, but maybe I need to read the whole series again, or the first 6 issues, to get it more. But they've been doing that throughout each issue, and I don't know how it ties in together yet. So it's things like this that keep me reading, because I'm very interested about how those are going to play out. But I don't know how they could do it without saying, this is a comic book with a book inside of it telling a story about someone telling another story about someone from another world. It's like, okay, that's a little bit too deep for me, guys. So it's a good book, though. I highly recommend it to anyone who's looking for, like, a cool fantasy romp with a grim, dark future
twist.
It's
so beautiful. Oh, my goodness.
And the art is just
astounding.
The artwork
is...
Yeah.
I think it's Benjamin Dewey.
Yes.
Am I totally pulling
I think
that
you're
out of... Okay,
Dewey,
good.
Yes, yes. So, it's a fun book. But,
so,
right,
Paul,
we're
pick it up. I think it's, like, $9, and first issue's huge and oversized.
Yes.
Worth your money.
Totally. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. The fact that first issue came out, and it was so long, just... It was an easy sell for a lot of people that I knew, because it was $2.99 for, like, 48 pages or something.
Oh, wow.
Which is a killer sale, so... yeah, we're going to take a quick break, though, and we come back. We're going to talk about comic book colorists. So get ready for some very in-depth discussion about comic books. We'll be back in just a minute. Our primary topic for this week's episode is going to be talking about colorists in comic books. Now, for those of you that don't necessarily know what a colorist is, you may have seen this in the credits of a comic book, but these are the people that take the penciled and inked versions of a comic and add color to them. Seems very straightforward, very obvious. But at the same time, this is probably one of the most overlooked positions in the comic book creation process, next to letterers, probably, the people that put the board bubbles on the page and the captions on the page. And it's actually a position that I think is growing in terms of, like, notoriety. People are actually noticing when a colorist is good or bad. And a lot of the times, you know, colorist is it's a very broad position, because it can be assisted to by the inker, or maybe the penciler, or maybe there's some direction given by the other creators of the book. But on the whole, this is something that I think the three of us, Nick, Paul, and myself, have been talking about for well over 2 years, in terms of, you know, this is a book that we're reading are very, very good because of those finishing touches put on the book by colorists. So I want to, you know, ask this question to you to Nick and Paul here. What makes a good colorist to you? Like, if you think of all of the books and all the comics that you've read, what makes the colorist, like, a key crucial component of the book, outside of obviously just putting the colors in the book?
Well, it's interesting, because a lot like letterers, who obviously are the ones who letter the book, by and large, colorists are only noticeable when they're detrimental in some sense. I don't want to... Do you know what I mean? Like, by and large, you don't notice them unless it's an issue. It's only a few examples, I think, and especially recently in the past maybe decade or so, that colorists have really kind of become a more prominent and celebrated part of the medium. But in the past, it's like, well, as long as the book... As long as all the characters were the right color, that's kind of all that mattered. It's only right. with the advancements in digital coloring, digital comics, and paper quality and printing quality that colors have been able to really become more of an expressive aesthetic part of the comic, I think. And I mentioned this last episode, but for example, a book like Justice League, the last issue, in terms of the story, wasn't as good as previous issues of Justice League, but the artwork and specifically the colors by Francis Manipal and Buccioletto, I can't remember his first name.
Yeah, Brian.
That's what elevated the comic from just like, oh, this is a good issue of Justice League, to holy crap, this is one of the best comics I've read all year. It was because of the colors and the sort of chances that they took with the coloring to really step outside what you'd expect.
Right.
So, I mean, colorists, when they do their job well, they're not maybe noticeable, but when they kind of step up and kind of experiment, that's when I think it stands out for me. When you see someone doing, for example, a Batman book by when FCO Palencia does the colors in the Batman book, and you have a Batman book that has like neon blue and pinks and purples, that stands out and that grabs your attention. Mm-hmm. When you have a Justice League book that's doing the same color palette, that stands out. So when colors become noticeable and really add something to the tone and feel of the book, that's really special, I think. And I feel like more, like you said, more and more that's being recognized and acknowledged by fans.
What about you, Nick?
No, Paul's completely right when he says that colorists are, by and large, you know, it goes by that whole age-old, you know, saying that only if you get noticed are you, you know, doing your job wrong.
Right.
And I think a lot of times that's very true with colorists. Sort of, it doesn't happen frequently where you are like, wow, these colors are like really, really off. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, for better or for worse, while you frequently see writers that are paired, that frequently team up with certain pencilers, and you see that a lot, but it's not regularly nonstop, like, for example, Snyder and Capullo, because obviously pencilers can only usually commit to one gig at a time. Mm-hmm. And so the writer may not always, you know, no matter how much a writer wants to work with a certain penciler, that's not always going to work schedule-wise. However, because colorists can easily juggle 3 to 4
Well, easily is a word that maybe we don't completely understand. Okay. In terms of, like,
we know that there are some colorists, and maybe these are the superhumans of the bunch, truly. But let's put it this way: it's not uncommon to see a colorist juggle 2 to 3 books in an individual month.
Totally,
more or less, and because of that, it allows them to really frequently pair up with certain pencilers, almost as if it's a package deal 9 times out of 10. And so normally when you say, oh man, the colors look really weird, most of the time you're probably also unsatisfied with the pencil work. I don't think that's a stretch to say. I think if you're a big high name penciler, you normally, at least this is my understanding of how the industry works, to some extent you call the shots on who, you know, colors for you.
Okay.
And so generally you find better colorists working with, you know, higher tier pencilers. I don't think that's a stretch to say. So it's Sorrentino with Marcello Maiolo, or
Declan Shelby with Jordi Belair, David Aja with Matt Hollingsworth. For a while, FCO Palencia was on Invincible with Ryan Otley, and they were just a killer team. I don't know if you guys knew that. Like, that's where I've seen that name before. I was on Invincible, and I think they worked together for 50-plus issues, and never have the colors been better on that book. And not to say that the new colorist on that book is bad, but that... I don't know if it's a guy or a girl, but, you know, that person does colors in a way that I didn't think was possible in a superhero book. And I haven't seen their Batman work, but I can't imagine it's bad.
It's stunning.
Yeah.
It's stunning, the stuff on Batman. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, sorry to hijack your point, Nick, but, yeah, when you see these pairings, it's definitely premeditated. It's not just like, all right, just grab a random colorist off the, you know, off the corner because, you know, they'll work for nothing and just put them on the book. It's,
right,
it's,
just
it's
pick one.
Very, very, I think, meticulous about who works well with what penciler and inker, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you get creators that are, you know, all in one packages, or maybe, you know, for instance... Jason Howard, who's on Trees with Warren Ellis, and he did Astounding Wolfman with Robert Kirkman back in the day, he does the full shebang. He does, you know, pencils, inks, and colors all himself. And I think Todd Nauck, who was on Invincible Universe, and he was on the Nightcrawler series before it ended, I think he does the full shebang as well. So it's a colorist is a very specific, I think, niche position, but more often than not, we're seeing, you know, you'll see a colorist on a book next to a penciler and maybe an inker as well. So, I mean, so to get back to the question then, what do you think makes a good colorist? Like, if we were to say, okay, we know what makes a bad colorist, it's when the tone of the color is off for the, you know, what's happening on the page. But when what makes a colorist stand out to you, where you say, wow, the colors on this book are fantastic? And, Paul, you kind of gave an example, but I guess let's talk a little bit more about that.
You know, like I said, it's like when the colors really stand out and add something to the book. You know, I don't know if it's something I noticed just because I knew we were going to be talking about this, or I just happened to read the right books this week, but all of the books I read this week seem to have a unique take on how to use color.
Okay.
Dave Stewart, who did colors on Twilight Children and a ton of other books, he's a really interesting colorist because he is one of these guys that can add a lot to a book without it being sort of super noticeable. He's not doing outrageous neon colors that like F. Seal Palencia is maybe doing on Batman, but the colors on Twilight Children, they're just stunning, and they add something to the feel of the book. It's a mysterious story, and the focus of the mystery is just a glowing orb. So how do you make a glowing orb feel threatening? Well, he sets a lot of the scenes at dusk, so the skies are red. It's like, oh, so it feels ominous. And it's just a color choice, the right tone of red against this glowing orb. It adds something to the book without it being, I don't know, without stepping outside the tone of the book, without hijacking the artwork in some sense. It's there to enhance the artwork.
Totally.
And I think that's something that's a lot of like modern colorists that are noticeable or notable really do is they are an equal part of the artwork. It's not just, all right, I'm here to make sure the Hulk is green and his pants are purple. It's make sure the art, you know, is make sure the aesthetic visual part of the art of the comic book works, you know, if that makes sense. It works visually in a sense.
Yeah, it's no longer sort of, and not to reduce the role of colorists in the past, but I think due to old printing techniques, and either of you call me out if you think this is wrong, but a lot of it used to be somewhat of a paint-by-number affair, so to speak.
Oh, totally. Well, they only had so many colors
Hulk needs
that they
to
could
be green
with.
23, and that's, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. And that, of course, was probably limited as well to the printers, you know, like they only had so many colors they could work with.
Exactly.
I mean, you look
so that's not to reduce anyone's role or anything, it's just that in the modern day and age, a colorist has a lot more tools at their disposal.
To your point, Paul, I think that idea of the color sets the like mood. It's without the color, a book would just be black and white inks, and you can't derive a lot of the emotion of the scene without those colors. And to think about like a book like Outcast, you know, Elizabeth Breitweiser's colors have been since issue number one some of the most powerful colors I've ever seen in a comic book. Like. Beyond any other book, like Outcast is a very unique Southern Gothic style story, and the colors absolutely reflect that. I think Paul Azeta, I can't say his name, Azeta. Yeah. I'm just gonna
Azeketa. That's what I was
saying. Azeketa. Thank you. Thank you.
Azeta, I don't know.
His pencils are astounding. His inks are fantastic. But it's the color of that book that sets the dynamic. Like you could have scenes, pages out of that book with brighter, happier colors, and it would totally change the entire tone of the situation. Especially given the way that it's written, I think Kirkman specifically leans on the art a lot in that book with facial expressions, and that's because the art alone by itself could be murals on on your wall, but there's a lot of emotion just in the pencils, and then the color just amplifies it and totally delivers that feeling to you. So I mean that's my one call out, and I mean we've got a whole list of colors here in our notes here, but like that I cannot get over how well colored that book is, like honestly.
Well, I want to follow up a point that you were both hinting at, this idea that it's contemporary colorists are adding a lot and being a valuable part of the book. And a lot of that has to do with printing technology. Just the more colors available and the ability to do more shades, and printing quality. And books that are look nice when in print, when I read them digitally, a lot of times the colors just pop a lot more, and that's just the way the colors are done.
Right.
Compare that to, you know, older comic books where you had a limited color palette and limited, you know, printing technology. I read a lot of DC books in those big, you know, showcase collections where they're just black and white reprints of old comics.
Yeah.
And I don't miss the color. Like, it's not that important of an element, really, because it didn't need to be, or they didn't have the ability to make it very nuanced and subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So the color, missing the color from those pages doesn't detract from the book at all. But if you were to read, like, an issue of Paper Girls, republished black and white, it would be a completely different comic book, right?
Absolutely. Well, I think you would just lose a lot of, I think you would lose a lot of, like, I keep saying emotion, but I think you would lose a lot of just, like, subtlety, because the way they did subtlety, I think, back in, you know, the 60s and 70s, it was, they would add, like, lines and dots. They would do a lot of that with inking to, like, make things look darker, make things look brighter. They would imply shine in older techniques. So that's specifically what it is, you know. They had, you know, less colors, so you had to imply depth, or you had to imply shadow, or, you know, there would be a lot of cross-stitching on someone's face, strictly done in art rather than it with any kind of color, to say, look, this guy has a beard, or, oh, he was injured on his face, rather than putting blood there, because they only had maybe, like, one or two shades of red to work with, and if you put, a splot of blood on someone's face, it looks like they got shot in the head, whereas if you just did a little cross-stitching on their face, you're like, oh, that person was injured. You could even hearken this back to, like, old Archie stuff, where you look at how basic the color scheme in those books are, and when, you know, Archie got hit in the head, you know, they would put a little cross stitching on his head to say, oh, that's where he got hit with the football, whereas nowadays they would probably, you know, maybe darken the lump on his head with a purple, or, you know, or a darker red or something. So the technology side of things, I think, has a lot to do with it.
And also it can be detrimental as well, because I remember when, you know, digital coloring became prevalent, and a lot of colorists overused it. A lot of books from the late 90s and early 2000s are kind of ugly, and the colors are muddy because they're trying to do too much, you know. I feel like there's a shift back to doing more simplistic coloring, but being able to use a wide palette. Like I mentioned Paper Girls, but man, the colors on that book are really odd when you think about it. It's a book that's supposed to be ominous and dark at times, but all the colors are sort of pastel. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pinks and blues, but it works to set an odd tone for the book, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like they're purposely trying to offset the tone of the book by adding like a happy look to it, but with darker undertones, which is exactly like what, you know, books like, if for some reason this book makes me want to think of, it makes me think of the Goonies, even though I know they're not related, but like Goonies was like, it was so happy-go-lucky and everyone was so positive, but like the stuff that was happening in that book was fucking dark as shit. Like that whole book just has these just very, very dark, horrible implications, but everyone's so happy-go-lucky that you're like, oh, it's the 80s and everyone gets a thumbs up freeze frame at the end of the movie. Paper Girls might be the opposite, or it might be like the same kind of thing, but with color instead of the tone of the characters.
Yeah, good point.
So I guess if we're moving, you know, if we're talking more about like the specifics of, you know, coloring with modern technology, I mean, where does black and white fall into this? You know, I don't think there are a lot of books out there that are of like, I guess like notability outside of maybe The Walking Dead that are strictly black and white. And maybe is Love and Rockets still in black and white?
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, there's a handful of books out there in black and white. So where do you guys think color comes into this? Like, I know that there isn't color necessarily in these books, but like, how do they, what do you think like is the primary difference here, other than obviously the lack of color? Like, how do they imply this like emotion to these pages without using color?
Well, of course there's no denying that, I mean, as we've discussed before, the printing and whatnot have all massively improved to a point that just having, you know, pencils and inks is not it's not like, well, you don't have color, so clearly, you know, you're not up to date or whatever. I mean, Batman Black and White is a perfect example of a series that doesn't have to have color, and it still has, you know, the full gradient of, you know, blacks, whites, and grays, and everything in between. And so you don't really feel like anything is lost. It just allows you to really focus on the inking and the pencils, and that's not a bad thing either, mm-hmm. honestly. I don't mind it at all.
Well, it's interesting because it makes you pay attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, and it stands out because obviously there's, like you said, there's very few books that are black and white. You mentioned Love and Rockets. That's interesting because I never really think of it being a black and white book because it always has been. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah, yeah. Right.
And just,
you just think of it as what it is.
It's, what it, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it, those, the Hernandez brothers are so indebted to classic cartooning, like newspaper comics.
Yeah.
Just, they just prefer to work that way. It works for their art style perfectly. But a book like Black Magic, which we mentioned earlier in the episode, that really jumped off the page for me because it is not necessarily black and white. It's all done in grayscale, but you don't see many books like that. And that book, the way Nicola Scott, who I think mainly did the colors with some assistance,
mm-hmm.
Uses the sort of grayscale, but then hints at color, very washed out color.
Oh yeah.
It makes the book stand out and it really sets the tone for the book. I don't think it would have worked for me as well had it been a fully colored book and not done in grayscale.
Yeah.
And obviously I think the Walking Dead kind of has to be in black and white. For the same reason, it fits the tone of the story.
Yeah.
And if black and white, if Walking Dead was in color, it might be too gruesome to read at some point. You know?
Absolutely.
You
kind of
have to do that.
Well, yeah. What's really interesting about The Walking Dead, and I don't know if you guys knew this, I might have hinted at it in the pre-show, Walking Dead actually has a colorist in quotes there by the name of Cliff Rathburn, and he does all of the grays for that book. So Charlie Adler does the art in that book, or the pencils and inks, and Cliff Rathburn comes in and actually does the grays, which is really interesting because like it shows the attention to detail that this book has about what it's doing with color. And there is no blood. I don't think there has been a color issue of Walking Dead. I think they might have done like a number one. And I know all the covers are in color. But as far as the interiors for this book, every single page has been in black and white with a grayscale. And I'm pretty sure Charlie Adler and Cliff Rathburn have been on this book since issue 7 after Tony Moore left. Mm-hmm. And it's something, it's always been an impressive thing to me to say that, to see how important those grays are to this book. Like, because it's not just pencil shading, it's not just cross hashing, it's not anything like that. It's actual well thought out, meticulous grays that they use to determine like all sorts of shades of, you know, blood and gore and dust and dirt and all that kind of stuff that maybe you wouldn't think was actually being paid attention to, you know, like that they weren't actually trying to do this. They are just fill this in with gray, but it's very important for them to do that, to distinguish, you know, objects and things and not make it look like something like Love and Rockets, which is just like black and white straight up. Like, it's right. I mean, I should say from the one Love and Rockets trade that I read, which was Maggie the Mechanic, you know, it was all black and white and there was no gray. And this book is just very like various shades of gray, and it's very well done.
As How much many? As,
well over 50, 50. Nick. Well 50. Over 50.
All right.
So, I think black and white comics can still convey the same like feelings and emotions that you can get out of color comics. I just don't know like how they do that. You know what I mean? That's the most interesting thing to me. So
yeah,
can you get
just a basic question within this modern day and age? Why do you choose to go without a colorist? Because honestly, I can't imagine. Especially for, you know, a modern book at Image Comics, that it's a financial thing. I don't believe that. I believe it's probably a stylistic choice.
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, if you're at Image, it's a completely different story. If it's two guys in their basement and neither of them are a colorist, then of course, yeah, maybe you choose to not go that route. But
yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of books,
something like,
you know,
Walking
they,
Dead, you know,
they purposely, you know, they'll do it a book in black and white just because they don't have the money for color to print it, you know.
Right.
But I think your point of saying, or I guess what you're trying to get at is, like, why would you work as the penciler, the inker, and the colorist? Is that what you're saying?
No. I was merely getting at it. It's just interesting that in this modern day and age, where color is almost certainly a given, it's always super fascinating to see the books that opt to not go that route at all. I mean, I remember reading this thing, I think Archie Goodwin, who was the editor on Batman Black and White, was talking about trying to pitch the idea of Batman Black and White, and everybody at DC's higher-ups were like, you realize what year this is, right? Like, no one is going to read a black and white book. Right. What's wrong with you? And of course, his, you know, claim was that, well, it's going to save us money, and it's going to be able, we'll be able to put out content faster. But yeah, it is sort of weird that we are at a position where if you don't have your book in color, it's like, well, do you not have the money? Is everything okay? It's like, well, maybe it's just a stylistic choice. And you're right. I think from what little I've read of The Walking Dead, when I think of the visuals, they are a little bit, you know, a little bit stylized, just a little, and a little cartoony. It's not hyper-realism, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think if that book was in color, I don't know if I would quite take the visuals as seriously, or, you know, with such a grim or that very grounded, serious tone as how they've done it, where they've actually removed the color. And so it takes on that, you know, harder aesthetic, even if the actual pencil work seems a little bit more animated.
Yeah, that's a good point. That the style choice for Walking Dead to go black and white, I think, has a lot to do with the book's success, oddly enough.
Totally.
For a black and white book to succeed that much in today's marketplace, I mean, that speaks to that commitment to that aesthetic choice.
Yeah, name another one that's on that. I mean, okay, sure. Name another comic book that's on that level. Period. Right. I realize that's unfair. But name another prominent black and white comic book you know that's even remotely on that level. And, yeah. And there's nothing. I mean, nothing that comes to mind, at least.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I guess we have a list of what we consider like good colorists, I guess. Do you guys see the benefit in potentially listing out maybe some colorists to keep an eye out for? I know that we've already named a few.
Yeah.
But if you had to say, you know, if you're looking at a book's credits and you're looking for some good color work for people that may or may not be paying attention to this type of stuff like we do, what would be a handful of people you'd recommend, or, and I guess like maybe accompanying books to, as good examples of that type of color work?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I know I mentioned Dave Stewart a couple times. His stuff always looks fantastic. I think Twilight Children is a great example of that. I kind of became aware of him when he was doing stuff on doing the colors for Jonah Hex back about 5 or 6 years ago. Just really stood out, his nuance and the way he uses particular shades of color. F.C. Oplencia, again, we mentioned him. Particularly his Batman work is just stunning, I think. Matt Wilson is another guy. I think he's the guy who's doing Paper Girls, and it's tremendous. He also has been doing, or did, since it's now ended, but he did the colors on Daredevil when Mark Waid was writing it, and Chris Samnee was on art, and that book's colors were so vivid and bright and just leapt off the page. So yeah, if I had to pick guys that I think are doing, or and women, I guess, even though I didn't mention any, but people who are doing great colors right now, Stewart, Wilson, Hollingsworth, and Palencia, the guys I'd look out for.
Gotcha. What about you, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, Mike, Paul had a pretty great list, and you know, some of those overlap for me, but otherwise, I would definitely recommend Marcello Maiolo, if I didn't just butcher his name. Mm-hmm. You see him a lot with Andrea Sorrentino, and you see him a lot with Jeff Lemire. So a lot of the time, those three tend to work together. He did some fantastic work on Green Arrow, where they would just, there would be these small inset panels where they would desaturate like a whole bunch of the page, the little panel, except for maybe like the arrow that he was firing, and everything else would turn into shades of gray and black and white. Mm-hmm. Oh man, just fantastic work. Him and Sorrentino together are a force to be reckoned with. I would also recommend David Barron. Barron is sort of a Valiant mainstay. In addition to Valiant's weird sort of, you know, rotating set of pencilers, they, I think, generally only have two colorists that are manning all of their books at any given point.
Oh, man.
And Barron, yeah. So that's kind of their approach. Again, they have a real interesting handle on all of these different things, but Barron does Bloodshot Reborn, Divinity, Book of Death. I believe the other penciler would be Brian Reber, And he also does an amazing job. I think both of them do great work. Otherwise, I can't say it. Stewart's work on Hellboy is just amazing. I think a lot of people might think it maybe lacks nuance because it seems like it's just a whole bunch of shades of gray and brown and black and red, but it's stark.
Yes.
It's absolutely stark, and it
stands out. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that, yeah.
So I don't care what people say about that. And Paul is completely right. Matt Hollingsworth, Chrononauts, The Wake. If you want to see a really interesting example of a colorist really bringing their trademark flair to a book and really changing the book beyond, you know, simply coloring within the lines, and that's not to minimize what they do. It's super hard, it's super tough, and like we said, it's really advanced. But what Hollingsworth does with Witches is super impressive. And I don't know if either of you guys read this book at all, but
I haven't.
He's sort of like, the color palette for this book is so weird, and it's all these bright technicolor, like he'll throw all these weird like colors. There are all these weird technicolor color splotches all over the book. Like they'll like fall off of the, it's almost like he was throwing paint at the page because there are these splotches that like go outside of the panels, and it's this odd sort of technicolor mess that I think subconsciously creates this weird sense of like anarchistic anxiety with this color palette that seems very much not suited for a horror book. But it just keeps bugging you as you keep reading, and you're like, what is going on? Again, I can't do it justice, but Witches, amazing, amazing, amazing color work. Totally unconventional palette for a horror book, but it does the job, I think, mainly because it's not what you expect.
Gotcha. Well, I'm glad that you guys left me with the two greatest colorists in comic books right now. mostly Jordy Belair, who is by far one of the most... The only way I could, she's probably touched more comic books in the last 5 years.
Prolific.
Than, yeah, she's one of the most prolific colorists in comic books right now. Thank you, Nick. She's colored books from Dark Horse to The Massive. She's colored, I guess she colored Deadpool number one. I don't think she did that. She did it. She's currently doing Injection. She worked on Marvel's Moon Knight with Warren Ellis and Declan Shelby. She colored all of the Series Zero with all of the 18 different artists that they had on that series. That is a feat alone, or just in itself. I think I already said the Manhattan Project. She worked on the one other book that I cannot think of. She's been, like, seriously, if you Google her in books that she's worked on in the last three or four years, her name is on everything that's been fantastic. And if you look at every single one of those books, the colors are just impeccable. Like, I can't express how impressed I am by her as a creator by herself. The other one is someone that I already mentioned tonight, which was Elizabeth Breitweiser. Her two most recent works that she's been working on are the one I mentioned already, Outcast with Robert Kirkman, and Paul, I can't even do it again.
Kazeda? I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
If he's listening, tell us how to
I'm
say
so
your
sorry,
name.
I'm Paul. You're such a fantastic artist, man. And she's also working on Ed Brubaker's The Fade Out. She might be doing the colors for Velvet as well. I can't be certain.
Yes.
She is. Okay. So
that's
all
right.
Of her work, like, talk about a creator who can embody a time period in color alone. Like, obviously, like,
yes.
Sean Phillips' art and Steve Epting's art on The Fade Out and Velvet, respectively, they're fantastic, and they do a great job, like, embodying the time period. But her color schemes are just – her color palettes that she's chosen for those books are just – perfect. Like, I don't know. It's like she took a picture from that time and made it into real life in color. It's astounding. So those are two of my favorite colorists, and I'm so glad I got to talk about both of them. So thank you guys for giving me that chance. but yeah, like it's something that you should be paying attention to, listener. Like if you're not paying attention to colors on books, or if you think a book is fantastic because of the art alone, look at who's doing the colors on those books. There are some exceptions, you know, J.H. Williams, who's done things like Batwoman. And he did Sandman Overture. Ding, ding, ding. You've probably got another bingo.
Yep.
And he's also done work like Promethea, I think he did with Alan Moore. He's he's an all-in-one type of creator. Marco Rudy is someone that does, you know, pencils, inks, and paint and all that stuff, or in color, I should say, all in one go. And he's one of those creators who has five or six different styles of just pencils and then coloring on top of it. Like, he's a wild card. Like, if you can read his Bucky Barnes Winter Soldier book that he's doing with Alice Cott, that's great, as well as some of the book that he did with Matt Kint, which was Marvel Knights Spider-Man. Like, I recommend that to everybody who likes comics, period. Whether or not you even like Spider-Man, the art alone for that book will blow your mind. And then there's you know, like I said, Jason Howard, Todd Nock. Nick, you had one other person in here in our notes. Dustin Nguyen. There are people that do colors, pencils, inks all on their own. And a lot of these people are also painting. So that has a lot to do with it, too.
Nguyen technically frequently has an inker in Derek Friedhoff's. But otherwise, yeah, for the most part, yeah, Nguyen, due to his painting style, doesn't need anybody else.
Gotcha.
And I have to mention, of course, Tom Scioli does the colors for Transformers vs. G.I. Joe.
Yeah, so I think there's another bingo for you out there.
That's the free square. I think Transformers vs. G.I. Joe is a free square on the bingo.
It's so obligatory. It's like,
If you follow him on Twitter or on Instagram, he'll post like process pictures when he's doing the colors, and it's all done by hand. It's all done with crayon, and it's kind of stunning that somebody's doing that still. So, and it definitely makes the book stand out because of it.
And the best part about it is a lot of these people, I mean, we're kind of getting away from the primary topic, but nonetheless, you know, a lot of these people they're on social media and they're posting these types of things, and they're, you know, the in process work or just samples and like examples of how they, you know, how they're working with things or what they're currently working on. Mike Henderson is someone that Nick always sends me links to, and he shows just like random pictures that he's drawing, as well as everything that
his warm-up sketches.
Yeah, like warm-up sketches and stuff. And so, like, seek these people out on the internet and follow them, because it's really cool to see how they work. Because, like I said, colorists aren't someone that we normally think about as being, like, I feel like we don't mention as often as we should, at least maybe 4 or 5 years ago we weren't, about, like, these are people that are key to the process that create something. And to see them do their work is way more impressive to me, at least, than someone drawing with pencils and inks, because coloring is an art on its own outside of just the drawing of the comic. So, I don't know. Take that as you will. That's my soapbox. Colorists deserve a ton of respect, because their job, I think, is so much harder in some regards than pencilers and inkers, but maybe I'm going a little bit too hyperbolic with that.
Well, I mean, I think we're not perfectly there yet, but I think we are finally reaching a point where most publishers are giving colorists their due. I can tell you that they're on the front of DC books now, and I think they're on the front of Marvel books as well. Correct me if I'm wrong. And even Image, I think they were a little late to the game, and I don't want to fully speculate as to why that was. I think maybe it has something to do with the fact that with them being creator owned, for some reason they felt that, like, if the colorist wasn't technically, I don't know, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think with a creator owned emphasis, I think they felt that it's like, well, here's the penciler and here's the writer, and they're the guys that came up with it or whatever, and maybe the colorist was brought in later, so
potentially
we have to put the creators' names on the front. Who knows? Yeah. But anyway, they were semi-late to the game, but they're there now. That's all that
matters.
And now we're just going to have to start our Letterers Are People Too campaign.
Really. Yeah, exactly. That's next. Yeah. 2016, Letterers Are People Too.
Really. And if you don't think so, go read comics like Sandman, and look at how they do the different letters for whenever he speaks, or the different, you know, bubbles for whenever he talks. I'm sure you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. That's probably one of the easiest examples that comes to mind. But yeah, I mean, our work is not done. Letterers, assistant editors, color flatteners, we still have work to do.
Yeah, and there's, yeah, with lettering, there's a lot to be said, too. I mean, but yeah, that's, I totally agree.
It's a different topic.
Yeah, totally different topic. But colorists, you guys, colorists, oh man, I'm so happy that we got to talk about this today. That's all. Because it's something that I've been noticing more and more and more over the last, like, 3 or 4 years. And it's become something that I, like, look forward to when I see a colorist that I know on a book. I'm like, this book's going to be beautiful. Like, pencils and inks aside, the colors are just going to pop. Like, it's going to it's acid trips without even any drugs, man. I love it.
No, you're completely right. Like, most of the time when I see a press release, they're always going to be like, well, it's this guy writing it, and this guy is drawing it. And then, of course, my question is, yeah, but I know it's this guy drawing it, but is so-and-so going to be his colorist again? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. did he bring him along, you know, quote-unquote, bring him along for the ride, or are we getting someone else? So,
yeah, that's some industry stuff that I think maybe we're not completely privy to. But we can do our research, and we'll have another episode all about how the process works, I guess. Maybe. I'm not promising anything, please don't hold me to that.
That sounds like a lot of research, and I don't know if that's really our you know, meat and potatoes here. I think we're more unsubstantiated claims and hearsay.
Yeah, but, and lots of soapboxing.
Yeah, we're like what the History Channel is to actual history, and I think that's where we are.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroyed the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Freshtone, Skylar Spence, Brock Berrigan, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep current with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter at destroythecyb, follow us on Tumblr at destroythecyborg.tumblr.com, and check out our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And as always, thank you for listening.